because I get distracted. Good morning. My name is Mike. I'm one of the pastors here, and I'm part of the Connect missional community. And talk to me or Liz, who is on music this morning, if you want to know more about that. And it's great to be preaching in this second sermon on our third run-through of parts of Matthew's Gospel. If you haven't got one of the little yellow books, I'd advise you to pick one up. They are yours to keep, to take home, to make notes in and bring each week. And it's a great opportunity to make notes, to have a little reference for yourself as we go through Matthew, and you'll eventually end up with a little library of your own handwritten notes about how awesome Jesus is through Matthew's Gospel. But first, I'm going to talk about something entirely unrelated to, and probably an unknown concept at the time Matthew's Gospel was written, which is skydiving. Some of you may know that skydiving has been, maybe is, I don't know, a hobby of mine. I've carried out 220 skydives in the past 13 years. And so I know a thing or two about what it feels like to jump out of a perfectly good airplane. Although, as skydivers will tell you, there's no such thing as a perfectly good airplane. And skydivers can seem like adrenaline junkies, like people who maybe have a reckless disregard for their own safety, people who just thrive on danger, on being close to death. But actually, that's surprisingly not true. Most skydivers I know are very rational people, very thought-through people. And there's nowhere that skydivers are more careful and precise and rational than when they're packing their parachutes. Packing a parachute is not a matter of simply stuffing some material into a bag. It's not the sort of end of camping technique that your dad used when he'd just get the knee on the sleeping bag to get it back in the bag. You have to be very careful about how you fold each part of the parachute. You have to make sure the lines which connect your harness to the material are all in the right order. You have to put little elastic bands at the right places. You don't want anyone to talk to you whilst you're packing your parachute. You don't want to be distracted. It's a very careful, slow process of preparation. It takes about 15 to 20 minutes, and that preparation is for a reason. That preparation leads to your protection. If you pack your parachute correctly, the chances of something going wrong on your skydive, of you experiencing a fatal collision with the ground at very high speeds, goes down dramatically, to the point where it can be considered a sport that people can go and do multiple, even hundreds of times. The preparation is essential, and it leads to your protection. In the three stories we have of Jesus in today's passage, we see a similar pattern. Jesus is preparing people. He's preparing them in different ways, and in each way it leads to their protection. Protection from things internal to themselves, protection from physical external forces, and protection from the spiritual realms. Just like the skydiver needs to be considerate and careful in the preparation of a parachute, we need to be considerate and careful in how Jesus is preparing us and how that can lead to our protection. We're going to talk about those two elements of preparation and protection as we go through the rest of this passage. But there's also another point which comes in right at the end of the passage, which is how are people responding to Jesus? Every week at Redeemer, if you come here regularly, we have a section right at the end of our service where we all say something in response to the blessing that is read at the end of a service. That response is really important because hearing this and thinking about it, preparation is only as good as the response you have once you hear how you should prepare. So throughout the rest of the talk, I'd like you to be thinking, how are you going to respond to this today? How did people respond then? And what can we learn from that as well? So we're going to look at the three sections of the cost of following Jesus, in the storm, and when the devil comes, with these elements of preparation and protection in mind. Firstly, in verses 18 to 22, it's subtitled in our passages, The Cost of Following Jesus. That's the subtitle that was added sort of by the translators. It's not in the Bible. But it gives us a useful idea about what this section is talking about. Jesus has begun here by giving orders to cross to the other side of the lake. He sees the crowd around him. And remember, in our previous series, we learned about the Sermon on the Mount, where he's preached this amazing sermon, this kind of manifesto to a huge group of people. And he's decided to cross to the other side of the lake. He wants to get away from everyone. He's decided that all the fame, all of the people clamoring, everyone wanting to see him, to be around him, to lift him up, to maybe make him their king, maybe by force, is not something he wants at this stage. He's moving away from people. He's saying, let's go somewhere where it's a bit quieter, where I can continue my teaching. And at this point, when the people realize that Jesus is leaving, a few people step out. They realize this is their chance. This is maybe their last chance to say something to Jesus about what they want from their time with him. The first person to speak in verse 19 is a teacher of the law. Teacher of the law tends to be from the groups of Pharisees or maybe the scribes, the religious elites at the time Jesus is preaching. And he says, I'll follow you wherever you go, which sounds like a really positive thing for the Bible to encourage us to do. I'll follow you wherever you go. Surely we would be really excited if someone stood up who was new here in church this morning and said, I follow Jesus wherever he goes. Jesus' response is a little bit strange. Foxes have dens and birds have nests, but the Son of Man has no place to lay his head. It's a little bit like a riddle almost. Why is he being so coy, so evasive with this teacher of the law? Now, for those of us who've read more parts of the Gospels, we'll see Jesus' interactions with teachers of the law don't often go particularly well. Often they will challenge him. They'll try and trip him up. They'll try and find a hole in his arguments. And when that doesn't work, they will do things like plot to kill him, which is obviously the regular thing you do when people disagree with your arguments. And Jesus tends to not have particularly great words for them. He calls them hypocrites. He challenges them far more than he challenges people around him who are maybe seen as visible sinners by people of the time. Now, it's not said in this passage, but some commentators have speculated that a reason for Jesus' response is he sees the heart of this teacher of the law. He understands that this person is most likely trying to get into his inner circle. They see that he's chosen disciples of fishermen and less worthy people and think, well, as someone who knows the scriptures, if I get in with Jesus, I'll be his main guy. I can just be there with him. I can ride along on his coattails. I'll be like the top Pharisee right now. And Jesus is warning him of something. He's warning him that you might think you can go where I go and get what I get, but you can't, because Jesus knows where he's ultimately going. He's not going to somewhere where he's going to be exonerated. He's going to be raised up, but it'll be raised up on a cross. The Pharisee cannot go there with him. But he's also preparing us in another way. He uses this phrase, the Son of Man. The Son of Man has no place to lay his head. And he could have said something else. He could have said, this guy has no place to lay his head. Or my man has no place to lay his head. I don't know. But he says the Son of Man. It's a specific phrasing. And Jesus uses this phrasing. It's repeated 81 times across the Gospels. Usually by Jesus about himself, describing himself as the Son of Man. And this is a reference to Daniel 7, which is a vision of God and someone coming from heaven like a Son of Man. Not like an angel, God's messengers who sort of come in and out and sort of sweep in out the story to deliver some news, but like one of us, someone coming from God to us, to be with us, to be like us. And Jesus uses this reference when he's referring to the fact that he is this prophesied person who's come from God. He's not just a human. He's the Son of Man that was foretold in the Old Testament. He's preparing people. He's saying, I'm more than you think. But he's also warning them about saying they can do what he's going to do, because you have to realize that they can't do what he's going to do. They can't just ride along on his coattails. They can't promise something like, I'll follow you wherever you go. They don't know what that means. It's a warning to us against over-promising. Oh, I'll do this thing. I'll do this thing. I'll do this thing. I'll do this thing. Oh, sorry, I forgot to do all the things I said I'd do. It's a warning to us against thinking that we should exonerate ourselves by how much we can do, because Jesus doesn't want that of someone. You'd think the teacher of the law here would be a coup for Jesus. Oh, one of the Pharisees, they're going to follow me. Yes, that's what I've been wanting all along. But no, he sees that this person is just going to follow him in a way that is bad for that person's heart. And he says, you are better off not following me for that reason. Another disciple said to him, verse 21, Lord, first let me go and bury my father. This person is referred to as a disciple. They're not one of the 12 disciples whom Jesus picked out, but they are referred to as a disciple. They're someone who has been following him, maybe for a little while before he's got to this point. They consider themselves his disciple. They're following his teachings. And he has, again, a weird response. Follow me and let the dead bury their own dead. Seems a bit much, Jesus, doesn't it? He's going to bury his father. What? C- Can you not just go and do that and then come back? Why do you say let the dead bury their own dead? That's a bit mean. Again, context is super important here. In the Jewish customs at the time, if this man's father had already been dead, he would have been there with the family already preparing for the burial. And so in this case, the assumption that we can make, and again that commentators have made, is that this man's father was not yet dead. He was maybe old, maybe he was going to die at some point, but he wasn't dead. It wasn't like he's saying, hey, Jesus, the funeral's tomorrow. Can I catch back up with you on Monday? No, he's saying, there's this thing I've got to do first that's a bit more important, and then you. The important thing and then you. That's the order we're going here. And Jesus is pointing out that he needs to be the most important thing. Jesus doesn't say that we shouldn't have connections with family and friends and relationships and engagement with our community, but he also says he should have a relationship with us. He knows that in this disciple's heart, he's going to say, let me bury my father. But then maybe after that, he'll say, actually, now my mother's really lonely. And then, but my brothers are struggling now. And my sister just had some kids. I need to look after them. And on it goes. None of those things are bad things for this person to be doing. But Jesus, again, knows the heart. This person is saying, these other things just come a bit higher than you, Jesus. So you'll be later. How many times do we do that? How many times do we say, oh, but when I've got that job, then I can spend some more time with the church community because I'll be a bit more relaxed. I won't worry about the money so much. When the kids start school, I'll just have more time to pray because they will be out of the house. Or when this conflict with my family is resolved, I'm actually going to go to my MC more because it's good to spend time with them. None of us are saying that we don't want to do these things. None of us are saying that these things that we do with our family, our friends, our community, our work are bad things. But it's where we prioritize things. It's how we order things. It's when there's always something that is ahead of our commitment to Jesus, to know him, to learn more about him, to build a relationship with him. That means that we're neglecting that relationship. We might be prioritizing other good relationships, but we are neglecting a relationship with the King of Kings, the one who made us. Jesus is protecting the disciples, the teachers of the law here, from their internal heart issues, the things that keep them from really, truly knowing him, whether it's that they want to big themselves up and be the big person, or whether it's that they want to just, they've got so many things that they want to do that they're just going to neglect a relationship with him. He's preparing them for who he is as the Son of Man and protecting them from their own desires, their own internal struggle to know him and love him. And then Jesus gets into a boat. This might be a story that we know a bit better. Definitely one that I remember. I was talking to Paul before. I remember being told this story as a kid. You know, it's a pretty impacting, powerful story. Jesus in a boat. There's like lightning and things, and he calms a storm. That's a good one for kids, isn't it? They get the idea of who Jesus is when he can calm a storm. And it's a thing we all know. Jesus gets up, he calms a storm, boom, Jesus, yes. But there's something we can often miss. I think this often happens with the stories that we're told as kids, that we sort of see the focus as one thing. And I keep finding that whenever I go back to the stories as an adult, especially if I'm preaching on them and dig in a bit more, I see a few things of going, oh, the point wasn't that thing that we were all told as kids. The point is this other thing. In this case, Jesus gets up and rebukes the wind and the waves. But notice in verse 26 who he rebukes first. He replied, "You of little faith, why are you so afraid?" His first challenge is not to the wind and the waves, but to the disciples. His first challenge isn't to say, oh, that storm isn't a good thing, let's get rid of it. It's to the disciples. "You of little faith, why are you so afraid? Why are you not trusting me? You've come all this way. You are actually committing to me in ways that some of these other people could not. And yet you still aren't trusting me with this." Notice, though, that straight away after that, he does calm the storm. He doesn't make the disciples all sort of line up on the deck and get themselves extra splashed before he goes, right, now let's calm the storm. Come on, let's let you experience it a little bit more, a bit more pain, a bit more struggle. Come on, oh, you're really nervous now. You want me to stop it? You want me to stop it? He's not mean. He's not punishing them, but he's saddened by their response. He's saying, you've come along with me because you think you can trust me with your eternal lives, your eternal souls, your relationship with the God who you've learned about since birth, maybe. And yet you can't trust me with this one boat. You people who've grown up on the side of a lake. And I have too. He prepares them. He wants them to know that this is an important lesson to invest in their relationship with him, to be able to trust him. And this is hard. This is a hard thing. When the storm is raging around you, when the lightning's flashing, when the wind is battering against the sides of your life, it is a hard time to suddenly whip yourself in to trusting Jesus. It is a struggle. And Jesus isn't saying here, until you trust me, I won't help you. He says to them, you need to trust me, and then he helps them. And it will be the same with you. In the storms of your life, Jesus will come and he might tell you, you need to trust me, but then he will calm the storms. That might look different. It might not look instant in the same way that these waves subsided, but Jesus always protects. And it's in the time between the storms, the calm, the moments where maybe the wind's just a light breeze, that we need to prepare. You have little faith, why are you so afraid? How can we not be afraid when the storm comes? In the storm is not the time to prepare for the storm, but before it, after it, is a time. I think these disciples probably got back to shore, and safe on shore, they sat there and said, wow, what would it have looked like if we had more faith? Jesus still calmed the storm. He still saved us. How much more amazing would that experience have been for Jesus to calm a storm if we'd all been with him saying, Jesus, we know you've got this. Let's see where it goes together. Jesus guides us to trust him. We can do that by reading his word, by learning more about him, by seeing his character. We can do that by praying alone, by praying in community, by being with our church community, our missional community. There are many ways we can invest in our relationship with Jesus. And the important thing is that we do. Before Greg's sabbatical, he did a series on reading the Bible. And part of that is about forming habits and building these things into your daily life. Saying you're going to start out with an hour a day of Bible reading is going to be a challenging thing if you haven't been reading the Bible. But saying you'll start out with 5 minutes is a way you can build that. You can build your knowledge of Jesus, looking on him, knowing him, seeing his character, seeing how he protects and saves people. The preparation is important, but the protection comes from Jesus regardless. How wonderful would it be to know and to trust that, to feel the storms battering and saying, Jesus is going to have this. He had it last time. He'll have it now and he'll have it next time. And to just keep trusting and let each time you trust, build up the trust for next time. Share these stories with people in your mission communities, with people in your lives. Share them with friends who are not believers. If you're someone here today who is not sure about your relationship with Jesus, know this, wherever it's at, he is going to protect you. And he would love it if after that you decided to know him more and know him deeper. And there are people in the church who can pray with you about that, who can talk to you about that. It's why we have our missional communities. It's why we connect with people. It's why we reach out to our communities. When the devil comes, verses 28 to the end of the chapter. This is a challenging passage, I will admit. The area of demon possession, sometimes referred to as spiritual warfare, is something I do not have a great deal of experience and knowledge and confidence with. Earlier this year, in March, myself and a group of other pastors of churches in Manchester actually met for a day to discuss spiritual warfare, to read detailed academic texts about it and discuss it with each other and pray through things and try and just get to grips a bit with what does this mean for us, for the congregations in our churches. If spiritual warfare is something that troubles you, that puzzles you, that confuses you, that makes you wonder how your relationship with God is shaped, please do talk to someone, talk to me, talk to Greg. We'd love to have those conversations with you. I'm not going to go super deep on what the demon possession means here, or the nature of spiritual warfare, you could probably do, again, a day of training on it. But I am going to say a few things which hopefully are very helpful and acknowledge the reality of a spiritual dimension in our lives. Once again, Jesus is preparing and protecting. And it's a bit harder to see through this passage, but hopefully we will see it. The first thing is interesting. These demon-possessed men are coming from some tombs. It struck me last week when Greg was preaching about Jesus encountering someone with leprosy. And leprosy was a bad disease. Jesus quite regularly encountered people with leprosy, and him healing them was an interesting sign, both of his healing of physical illness, but also healing something that was considered ritually unclean. People with leprosy could not go into the temple. They could not be near to God because they were unclean. And the same is the case with these men at the tombs. I find it very interesting that these demons have driven the people to the tombs. They've driven them somewhere where not only are they scaring people and probably not having a particularly great time living around tombs, but also that they have made them ritually unclean. Even if these men were healed or were able to make it into town, they would not be allowed to the synagogue because they've been around dead bodies. They are unclean in the Jewish law at the time. The demons have driven them somewhere that seems out of reach of God. Do we think we know people who we feel are out of reach of God? Someone who we just think that person's just, they're just never going to come to a church. Do we feel there are people who we don't want in our churches? Oh, they would just be, they'd be difficult. Like, just don't want to have to deal with them on a Sunday as well. Jesus encounters these people who've been driven from everything they know about their society, who've been violent. Who knows whether the violence was because of the demons or because they felt so alone, so betrayed, so distressed at their situation. And then he says, have you come to torture us before the appointed time? And this is a really interesting one. The demons are acknowledging something that other people around are struggling to do. Other people here have been like, oh, he's a teacher. Maybe he's going to overthrow the Romans. Or maybe he's just a guy with some good ideas. And we encounter that today from the society around us. And these demons are pretty straight at naming it. What do you want with us, son of God? Well, there we go. It's spelled out. Of all the people who could spell it out for us, it's demons. Have you come to torture us? What a strange phrase that is. Have you come to torture us? And you'll notice in this whole interaction, it's very obvious in the app Bibles. If you've got one of the app Bibles that like labels what Jesus says in red, Jesus says one word in this entire passage. The demons have all this stuff to say to him. They accuse him of being the son of God, which is a pretty bizarre accusation, if I'm honest. Have you come to torture us? There's reasons they would say that, but we won't dig into those just now. And then they ask about these pigs. If you've watched something like The Exorcist or really any film dealing with spiritual things, you might expect that an exorcism has to be done with magical water and shouting of incantations and screaming and loud strings in the background. In this case, Jesus says one word. He says, go. Go. All these things that we have from our society that try and make demons out to be something weird and scary, and it requires like teams of priests and really complex things, are there to blind us to the truth that Jesus has ultimate power in this situation. I think this is where the preparation of this passage comes through. The preparation here is for us. We can see something about Jesus here. We can see something about his relationship with the spiritual world that is so beyond the things our culture and our mythology has tried to conjure up to scare us, to keep us worried about things. And who knows what spiritual influences there are in even that being how we think about spiritual things. And Jesus says one word. He says, go. And they're gone. And look, the demons even have to ask for where they go. If you drive us out, send us into the herd of pigs. This reminded me of the book of Job. At the start of the book of Job, God is talking about his servant Job and how upstanding he is. And the devil is somehow communing with God at this point and says, Job only likes you because you've given him nice things, right? He's got a 4-bed detached house in Chorlton. He's got a new car, and his kids just got into a grammar school. So, of course, he's doing well. Like, that's why he loves you, God. That's why he's giving all his stuff away, because he's down the Maker's Market every weekend eating a pie. And God says, no, that's not it. That's not it. This person loves me for me. All that stuff is just window dressing. And the devil says, okay, I'm going to give you a challenge. I'll take it all away from him. And then God has to give him permission. God has to give the devil permission to challenge Job in this way. If you know Jesus, if Jesus is in your life, you are absolutely protected from spiritual forces. There is nothing that can come at you that Jesus can't say, go, and it will go. There's nothing that can come at you that doesn't have to ask permission from God first. We can have assurance of that. Whatever we think, know about spiritual realms, we should understand that Jesus is stronger and more powerful. We should be prepared that this is something we could encounter. But Jesus protects us. Knowing that Jesus protects us means we can approach those things in a way that doesn't cower to the influences of the devil, but instead acknowledges that God has power so much greater and over everything. The pigs are a confusing element in this story, though, aren't they? Of all the things that we have going on here, why the pigs? I've heard some commentators mention, I didn't actually hear them, I read them online. I've read some commentators saying that some people get a bit upset about the pigs because it's destruction of property. I think that's a really interesting viewpoint for someone to have, to be super worried about the property destruction after this. Maybe they're worried about where the taxes will go or where the people will get their pig meat from. They weren't even eating pigs, I guess, afterwards. But there is something in that. We've talked about these people who are afflicted. They're cast out. They're far from God. And to look at the parallels in our world, are the people we think are far from God. And what's interesting is that the response of the town is not driven by, Jesus, this is amazing. These guys were like freaking out in the tombs and you've saved them from the demons. We want you to, can you stay around in case more demons come from these tombs? Because we really don't like it when they do. But actually their first thought is, oh, what will we do without the pigs? We needed those pigs. They were dealing with all our rubbish. And these guys, I mean, yeah, it was weird, but like they stayed near the tombs. They were far away. We had it okay over here with the pigs. They stayed outside the village. Could you not have left it alone, Jesus? Sometimes when Jesus challenges us to do these things, to reach out to people who are afflicted and oppressed and cast out, it's going to look like we've lost something as a result. It's going to look like our property has been damaged or thrown into a lake. Sometimes we will take a loss, a material hit, in order to do something good and right for someone else, whether that's to share the gospel with them and lose a connection, or whether that's to bring someone in who other people think, oh, I'd rather they weren't in church today. This is a challenge to us to think about what we're really holding on to. Is it the things we have? If we knew that someone could be freed from the affliction of sin and death, but our herd of pigs or our healthy bank balance or our certain future that's been planned in a certain way that's going to work out really well was going to be tossed aside because of it, how would we respond? Or would we accept that Jesus' protection extends beyond that, that Jesus calls us to be part of delivering that to people who are struggling and who are afflicted? And this is where we have a question of how we respond. The whole town went out to meet Jesus, and when they saw him, they pleaded with him to leave their region. We have this today. People encounter Christians and they might plead with us to leave their region. But we also encounter it internally. We sometimes think, oh, if Jesus just hadn't done that thing, I just like to be one step back from that. I wish he hadn't challenged this thing in my life, the way I use my money, the way I use my time, the way I parent my children. I'd like him to stay one step back from that, because I've sort of got that on my own. Do we take time to plead with Jesus to leave our region? Do we think that's an important thing? Or do we say, okay, God, you're here. I guess we'll listen to what you've got to say. You did save those people after all. You did calm the storms. And you did warn us. You warned us there'd be a cost. In the story of calming a storm, what is our response going to be when we go away from here today? Some of us will be in a storm right now. I know that. There's enough people in this room that some people will be in a storm. And for those people, I say, this is not a call for you to go away guilt-ridden, that Jesus somehow isn't rescuing you because of your faith. But it is a request to consider that Jesus can protect you, that you can still reach out to him in whatever small ways, small cries from the front of the boat. Jesus isn't sleeping. Maybe he's resting. Maybe he's waiting. But he's not ignorant. For those of us who aren't in the storm just now, this is an opportunity. This is an opportunity to know Jesus more. Our response can be to say, yes, with this time I've been given, or with this group, missional community, core group, just friends I've been given, let's press into that faith, that knowledge and understanding of Jesus, so that when the next storm comes, and I'm sorry to say it will, we're ready for it. Not ready in the sense that we can now fix these problems ourselves, but ready in the sense that we can go to Jesus and say, well, here's the time for you to do that. And finally, in our response to the cost of following Jesus, do we have those moments where we overcommit? Yes, 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 yes. Ah! When we realize we're overburdened. How can we think about what is the right thing to do? Be diligent with where we promise. Be understanding of God's requirements to us, but not seek to be the savior of other people, but rather guide them to our savior. And at the same time, what things in our lives are we saying, oh, that's the thing first, Jesus, and then you? How long is the queue of things that are waiting before we get to Jesus? Because the times that we need Jesus is always. It isn't just waiting for the next storm. It's not a breakdown cover service. It's not saying, oh, when this thing goes wrong, that's when I go to Jesus. And then the rest of the time, just keep going to church and just hope and hope and hope. And then, oh, Jesus, right, get on the phone. And then you realize your renewal hasn't gone through. No, that's breakdown service, not Jesus. And you have these interactions that are just so up and down your whole lives. Wouldn't it be good if we can moderate between over-promising and under-delivering, and just build that relationship with Jesus? Because the thing is, Jesus does do it all. In this passage, we see him help people's internal heart lives. We see him calm a storm and help the physical world change and protect them around them. And we see him go into spiritual realms that are sometimes weird and confusing, and we'd rather just not read those passages sometimes. But even then, Jesus goes into them. And just as Jesus is saying to this Pharisee that you can't follow me to everywhere I go, we know that Jesus went somewhere that we cannot go. Jesus went eventually to the cross. And he did that as a means, again, of our protection. Protecting us from the deserved punishment for our sins and death. And just like in these passages, before he went to the cross, he prepared his disciples. He prepared them. He gave them something to do, a ritual to do, to remind them continually. I always find it interesting that of all the things Jesus could have done to prepare his disciples, he did a meal. a meal, that sign of fellowship and community and being together, like we are here in church this morning. He didn't give them a set of commands to read out, verses to recite. You know, make sure you go over this five-point creed before to remember me. No, he gave them a meal, something simple, something that they would do regularly all the time with each other, eating bread, drinking wine. And that was because that allows them to continually respond, to continually think, yes, Jesus prepared me, and then he